Welcome back to Occasional Randomness. I'm your host, Eric Scott, and joining me, as always, is my fellow co-host, who's usually a dog lover, Jason Johnson.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, at least at this point, this dog is way too much of a handful for me to keep up with.
I don't know, six legs? I mean, you know, that's quite a dog.
Yeah, but you only have two hands, so.
But it's got way too much teeth and not really housebroken there, so yeah, not really good. Don't want to bite off, you know, feet and hands, and, you know, that's not really a good thing.
Yeah. I put my foot down at that point.
Yeah, and leave it there. Yeah. All right, so here we are, starting the final season of Farscape, season 4. Only 21 more to go after this, plus the two-part Peacekeeper War miniseries. I guess given that it took us over a year for season 3, we'll see how long it takes us here to get through season 4.
We will milk it for all it's worth.
That's true. And so, in keeping with the theme of how we do things around here, we'll kick things off with Season 4, Episode 1, Crichton Kicks. And after that, since they released a whole bunch in sequence here, we'll discuss the next 6 episodes of Season 3 of Star Wars The Bad Batch, Episodes 6 through 11. Which I guess it kind of fits. You know, we did the first third, this third, and then we'll do the final third, maybe. So, yeah, there you go. That kind of works out.
Symmetrical.
That's right. And as always, if you like what we do here, please give us a like or review wherever you listen to this at, or sign up on our YouTube page, or follow us on X/Twitter, or even on Facebook. Just look for Occasional Randomness, and that's us. Or better yet, help spread the word and let everybody else know about us. We'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, here we go. The probably equally as long as before recap of Farscape, Season 4, Episode 1, Crichton Kicks. Apparently it's been months since Moya was sucked into a wormhole, and Crichton is outside in his module with a huge beard in full swing, so I guess, again, that's why you know it's been months. He's talking with the pilot who rescued him a long time ago, I guess months then, saying he's almost out of fuel, so he needs a little help here. He apologizes, admitting that he now accepts his friends aren't coming back from the wormhole, and he can't leave this new Leviathan and pilot, and just asks to be let back in. Not getting an answer, he shouts, awakening the female pilot, who says she must have dozed off. John goes back aboard the aging Leviathan, and this pilot tells him that since what they have won't work in his module unless purified and reduced, there's nothing on board that can fuel his module and his escape before they die. And that's the Leviathan and the pilot, not John. Because she says and clarifies that she and Elak, the Leviathan, promise each other that they die in the sacred burial ground when they were joined over 350 cycles ago. John says that he would have died a long time ago without them, but he's almost cracked wormhole for dummies, quote-unquote. Crichton's only companion aboard Elak, besides the pilot, is the final remaining DRD, which he has nicknamed 1812. And he's also taught it to play the 1812 Overture, which it plays all the time, which is kind of funny. Crichton, who's gone a little bit crazy as a result of his prolonged isolation, see 1812 DRD, goes to the maintenance bay where he's been working on his wormhole equations, which now cover many walls, surfaces, crates, pretty much everything. When pilot tells him there's a small craft approaching, and it's out of control, the ship flies into the bay and crashes into a load of crates, destroying many of the equations before coming to a halt, of course.
So it's kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch. You shake it, and the writings all disappear.
Yep, and good luck getting that back again. Out steps an enchanting redhead, who's met by Winona, John's pulse pistol. She is Sokozu Shanti Sogezi Shanu. And that's the last time we'll say that, and we'll just call her Sokozu from now on.
I was going to say, I'm glad you got that one.
Yeah. And suggests he aims his gun behind him as the creature is following her, execute on sight. And she asks what he is now going to do for her. Sokozu tells John that there shouldn't be anybody aboard the dying ship, but he cuts her off with a who, what, where, when, why, and how. She informs him that her brain can't tolerate translator microbes, and she must learn his language by hearing it. So she points around to various things around the bay, and Crichton tells her what they're called, and at her prompt recites the alphabet. Pilot tells John that another vessel approaches, one much larger than before. Sokozu asks if Elak can starburst, prompting John to point out that, hey, she speaks pilot. Sokozu tells him to make sentences, nouns, verbs, so he tells her that once upon a time, he was happy here, a little on the lonely side, but that was okay as Winona only had to start cooking fires. And his module's out of fuel, and he's not going anywhere, and he's working like a mofo, with everything finally coming together on the crates until she smashes on through, pissing him off just a little bit. The only thing he had going for him, she just destroyed. Sokozu says that the Grudex will shock the hull, incapacitating most functions. Not pilot, though. They need to keep her alive to harvest the tubrae tissue, whatever that is. Suddenly they hear people boarding, so Sokozu quickly tells John they need to find an enclosed space as the Grudex are about to fumigate. which doesn't sound good.
Yeah. Wasn't there a Star Trek episode about that?
I think so. Well, that was a little more crazy than this, but yeah, close enough. Starship Mind, I think that was called, right? Die Hard in Space. Anyway, the two are in John's module, where he asks who the Grudex are, to which she replies, Tubray Hunters. Okay, thank you. But then clarifies that Tubray is Leviathan neural cluster tissue consumed by many cultures to enhance higher brain functions. She was with the Grudex until she had to flee for her life. The organization she works for was hired to find Leviathans, so she was given half a cycle to become an expert on their functions and habits. She worked really hard to find the sacred place because Tubray is richer with age, and of course her reasoning is that harvesting this Leviathan is better than killing a young one, along with everybody on board. Which, yeah, makes sense. We cut to John's mind. He's on a beautiful beach, and he and Harvey are running along the shore. Harvey asks him how many men have a challenge, a goal, a destiny, clear as his, and tells him to stay focused on the riddle of the wormhole. Affect the things he can only affect. A familiar voice, a lady sunbathing nearby in a bikini, tells John that Harvey is right. It's Erin. And John asks her to tell him why she left. She rolls over, revealing that she is pregnant.
Very pregnant.
Yeah. And says that she's not right for him. She was just the best of limited choices. He says, hey, that's his kid, Crichton's kid, but she says, this is her child. Back in reality, the Grudex arrive on board the ship and begin to hunt. John's trying to bring Pilot back to consciousness, but she has virtually no systems at all at her disposal, so she recommends they save themselves. Maybe in passing, she and Elak can save some others. John wants to fight for them and asks for any DRDs that remain with weapons. He asks Okozu if they can negotiate. She says, nope, that's not their way. So he says that it's time for a show of force and shouts some Klingon at them, because they kind of look like Klingon-y kind of people. One of the Grudex shouts back that they have no quarrel with him, so remain clear and he may live. But John says not to destroy the ship, so the Grudex tells him, well, then flee then. And John flips that around and says, no, you've got 60 microns to get off. But the Grudex don't like that and open fire on him. John fires back, adding that a show of force is the only thing that Klingons understand. Sokozu tells him to make them think he's dead, but nah, he decides to fire again, prompting them to release a Brin's Hound, a blood hunter. The aforementioned sick-legged dog thing.
Arf.
Woof. So they run away, and Sokozu expects to find a hatchway in a certain place, but it's not where she expects, prompting John to mention that, oh yeah, by the way, every Leviathan grows to accommodate its passengers. And he realizes that Sokozu's never actually been on one before. They run to where the supposed hatchway is. The hound jumps past them, then circles back as John opens fire at it. Sokozu runs up a wall, hello Matrix, and calls for him to hurry up and shift his gravity center. That's not possible, so he shoots again and runs into a small space just as the hound bites his leg. We cut to, I guess, the medical bay or somewhere where Sokozu's fixing up John, commenting on how his vein in his leg needs to be smaller to accommodate shifting his gravity center.
So, that's how it works. We got it now.
Oh, of course, yeah. Small veins, that's how it works. Yeah. He asks again why she ran from the Grudex, and she replies that she, too, was too good at her job. By finding the sacred burial space with mature Tubray tissue, she sabotaged her own self, breaching her contract so the Grudex don't even have to pay her. The Grudex continue to hunt, and Sokozu knows they have not found what they're looking for yet, as the lights in the area are still active. John's coming up with a plan to ambush the Grudex when he gets a comm from Chiana and Rigel, who are wondering why he's here, and they're in the maintenance bay. Say, what? The Grudex find John and Sokozu, and their leader, Ilkhog, says it's certain Sokozu won't tell anybody about this place when she's dead. Yeah, that's kind of how that works.
Yeah.
John gets up and aims at Ilkhog, saying that he'll take their earlier offer and run away. The Grudex fire, but are held off by 1812. Da-da-da. As John and Sokozu run away, the hound catches up to them and bites off Sokozu's hand. Ouch.
Golf clap.
Yeah. Well, one-handed golf clap. Fade to John shaving, as Chiana berates Sokozu, and Rigel asks if John has seen Moya. Chiana and Rigel's pod isn't going anywhere. They were lucky to get this far. John asks what's wrong with Chiana, so she asks Rigel to tell him what's the matter. Rigel instead asks why John's shaving now, and then Chiana just blurts out and tells John that he is what's the reason, what's the matter with him. It's him. It's always him. She shows a wanted beacon with Commandant Graza offering huge rewards for the capture of any Moya crew, dead or alive. Chiana's got a 5 million currency pledge on her. Worse still, the beacons are everywhere. Literally everywhere. Every port. Every bar. Every ship that can fly. All because of John. So she goes over and kisses him, okay. As Rigel adds, oh, by the way, he's worth 7 million. Chiana asks why he's shaving now, and he answers that he's finally figured out the wormholes. Don't see why you have to shave for that, but whatever.
That's what you do when you figure out wormholes. You have to shave.
Yeah. Maybe he's more skin face to write on. Maybe so he has to shave. I don't know. Rigel's surprised as Crichton reminds them who better to save Leviathan than them. Sokozu says, oh, by the way, when you're out there, go fetch my hand as she can rebond with her flesh. Okay, cool.
That's handy.
Hey. John tells Rigel, hey, why don't you go get it? And goes off with Gianna. She tells John not to confuse her and Sokozu, prompting him to pin her up against the wall to talk about it, whatever it is. She says that her visions have evolved. There's a cheat-proof game in the casinos that they're at, and she won 7 times in a row. And they arrested her, had a little fun, and tortured her. Nothing new. She no longer sees the future, but rather the present. It slows down, but leaves her with blinding headaches, and as if it uses up her eyes so she can't see. And each time it happens, the effect lasts longer and longer. John says that they'll find a way to fix this when they get out of here, but to screw the dog, they'll need a rope, a rabbit, and a membrane. Chanda decides, yeah, I don't know what that means, so she goes gets the rope and leaves the rest to John. Meanwhile, Rigel gets as close as he can to the Grudex, telling John they're still down there. Well, yeah, because they're not done yet. Cut to John back on the beach with Aaron, feeling the baby kick. Hey, episode title. He says that it's a boy, but Aaron says girls kick harder. John retorts that maybe it's not his, and she says he just won't let that rest. And after suggesting other possible fathers, they feel the kick some more. And back in reality, Rigel finds John in the corridor and mentions that he sees he's still obsessed, and John asks if Aaron said anything to him before he left. Goodbye, good luck, good riddance, he replies. But John says that's what Rigel said, and he's not obsessed. He asks again, and Rigel tells him for once to listen. When your lover leaves you repeatedly, take the hint. John replies that was the plan, but Rigel knows how his plans go. Meanwhile, Chiana finds Sokozu striking a bargain with a Grudek and shoots him. She and Sokozu get into a fight before John and Rigel arrive to pull them apart. Chiana tells them that Sokozu tried to make a deal with the Grudex and points to the currency, which Rigel recognizes as Scaran currency. Sokozu wonders, with the Nabari, Hynerian, and John, all from Peacekeeper realms, what kind of currency do they have? She explains that she is Kalish, and they hate the Scarans, but she did corrupt in their territory. John asks what her plan actually was, and she says she bought them a ship, which the Grudek would leave behind so they could leave. Shida notices a shake and tells the others that the Grudex have found what they're looking for, so they will be dead soon anyway. And then John leads him to a nearby open hatch when Rigel asks why they've not been sucked out yet, and he says Pilot is holding it closed with an electrostatic membrane, but one hit and it's busted. And this is how they're going to get rid of that Bridgehound. Sokozu realizes that the tubery harvesting has begun, so she and Chiana go to find the slaughterhouse, despite the Nabari's objections, while Rigel will be the rabbit to the hound. On the way to the Grudek area, Chiana and Sokozu argue, with Sokozu climbing a wall to show Chiana that she can go places that Chiana can't. Yeah, show off. Rigel soon runs into the hound as John finishes preparations and then lures it out, but the hound does not hit the door. The third attempt is the charm, and it gets sucked out, with John only staying on board thanks to the rope around his waist.
Ah, that's what the rope was for.
There we go. Meanwhile, Ilkhog walks up behind Sokozu and says that he's been expecting her. Dun-dun. Sokozu tells him that her contract prevents her from revealing the sacred ground's location, and, you know, John is highly ineffective. He will fight, though. Ilkhog says that his worries are now through, and Sokozu sarcastically hopes she isn't one of them. He says no, he'll honor her contribution and take her with him if she'll divert John and the others, and she thanks him. John grabs Sokozu as she leaves, takes her to the pilot's den, where Pilot says she's had 6 children, leading John to call Sokozu a mummy killer.
Aww.
Low blow. Sokozu says she simply follows her orders and tells him not to moralize with his narrow perspective. So take it back there, buddy.
You and your narrow perspective.
That's right. Chiana plays back a transmission, though, that Pilot intercepted, in which the Grudex say no other suitable Leviathans were found, and Sokozu's employers have been made aware that, through her own error, she lost her life. Sokozu gets upset and says that's not fair or right, but John adds that she has limited options. In short, help them or die. So here's John's wonderful plan. They've created a pulley system set up atop of Pilot's den, and the plan is that, with Chiana starting at the top and John at the bottom, Chiana will use her time-slowing powers to get a good look at the hoses the Grudex are using, so Sokozu can inform John how to use the hoses to kill the Grudex. Then, a heavy bucket will be used to propel John back up, and he will shoot the pipes and hopefully get rid of the Grudex. Let's fly, Chiana says, and the plan gets underway. Crichton swings down on the pulley, going past the Grudex, who don't see him. Chiana on the other end, and jumps off and ends up in front of the Grudex, who shoot, but as they do, she slows down things with her new powers, and as the shots miss her, she spots 3 hoses that John must shoot.
That's convenient.
Yeah. Easy. However, as always with most plans, she's pulled up to the top, but is blinded. She informs Sokozu of the hoses, and with her description, Sokozu tells John to shoot the right pipe first, which will release a volatile gas, then the left pipe, which will release the substance to stop the explosion from destroying Elac entirely, and finally the center to trigger the explosion itself. No deviation. Don't screw it up. And of course, immediately the plan starts going wrong. As Chiana can't get hold of Sokozu's hand, and she's swinging down, she accidentally pulls it off again, ew, causing Sokozu to grab at her, and the pair of them fall, pulling John up really fast in the process. 1812 provides covering fire, and John manages to shoot the hostess in order. Yay! Causing the explosion that kills the Grudex. Unfortunately, the combined weight of Chana and Sokozu breaks the pulley before John gets to the top, sending him falling to the bottom. Sokozu reminds Chana not to drop her hand. As the two land safely, Rigel tries, and I use that term loosely, to catch John, but he falls straight past him and lands right in the pool of bat droppings that inhabits the bottom of every pilot's den that we saw last season. That was disgusting. With the threat gone, John tells Sokozu that she might not want to go with them, as they're not the best traveling companions. She replies, I'm going to get my life back. I'm not going to end up like you.
That's what they all say.
Yeah. And we'll see how that goes. John tells Pilot that he hates that she and Elak have left the sacred burial ground, but she responds that the returning Grudex ship would have killed them anyway before they left, so the two of them want to repay their debt before they pass. John says they don't owe them anything, but Pilot says, nevertheless, they should soon arrive at the planet John thinks his friends are on. And even though it was her and Elak's dream to die in that sacred place, no dreams are guaranteed. The grace of age is that they learn to accept. As John's walking down a corridor, he returns back to the beach, telling a now non-pregnant Aaron that he's not coming here anymore. It doesn't really change anything, and just makes him sad. What's left is wormholes, as he must now rebuild the equations after New Girl smashed them up. Aaron says that new is good. Not always, is his reply. Some guy walks over, handing Aaron a drink, and asking who John is. John says nobody, and walks away. Back in reality, on Elak, 1812 joins John, and breaks off something for him to write with, as the overture plays, and John begins working on the wormhole equations once more. The end.
Dun dun dun.
Dun dun. Alright, some exercise trivia, because it's the beginning of a season. The beach scenes were filmed at Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. Claudia Black's scenes were shot during the filming of Season 4, Episode 5, Promises, so we won't get there yet. The lion's Crichton shouts at the Grudex is actually based on the real Klingon language, created by Mark Okrand. Ben Browder asked Ricky Manning if he could find something that roughly meant, get the hell off my ship. And new episode, new season, new stuff. This is the first episode of Farscape filmed in widescreen, although 4x3 versions were also created during post-production for broadcast in some location. Not sure if I remember if I'd noticed that or not. I'll have to go back and look. The opening scene where Crichton sums up his situation was added as a voiceover to explain to the new audience what was going on and help regular viewers catch up on what happened between Dog with Two Bones and this episode. Unlike with Jeremiah Crichton, way back in Season 1, Episode 14, the beard Bren Browder sports in this episode is actually a real beard. He grew it in the hiatus between Seasons 3 and 4 and shaved it during the filming of the episode.
That was a serious beard for one hiatus.
Yeah, that's like real method acting, yeah. Elak's pilot was created by the Intermention Creature Shop using the foam insides from the regular pilot puppet. And so a new pilot puppet was created for pilot's appearance in Promises. So I guess that's when we'll see pilot again, so spoilers.
Mm.
And the end credits of this episode play the 1812 Overture, which is a song Crichton whistled periodically throughout the episode, and that he taught 1812 to play. This is one of only three episodes to do that, and not play the traditional Farscape theme song during the rolling credits. Scratch and Sniff, Season 3, Episode 13, being the first, and Bad Timing, which is Season 4, Episode 22, so we got a long way to go for that one, that features no music at all in the ending credits. This episode introduces Rayleigh Hill as Sokozu, who, like Jewel, has red hair. Although she appears in virtually every episode in Season 4, she's only ever credited as a guest star and not added to the opening credits.
Oh, guess she's sticking around then.
Yep. The DRD dubbed 1812 is also introduced in this episode and becomes a regular for the remainder of the series. Aw, cute little guy. Okay. The main titles for this season was again brand new, with a new voiceover, different clips, and the removal of Lanny Tupu and Paul Goddard from the credits. And as we mentioned before, Chiana's powers have changed from the precognition before to speeding up her perception, making what she sees appear to slow down. This leaves her blind temporarily, as we saw.
Didn't see that one coming.
Hey, neither did she. And this is the first episode of the series to not feature any involvement at all by Lanny Tupu, given that this is the first in which neither Crais nor Pilot appear. So that means Ben Browder is now the only actor to appear in every episode of Farscape. All right, so another long recap and lots of trivia to go through. But hey, you know, like I said, it's the kickoff to a new season, and there's lots going on, lots of changes happening, both behind and in front of the screen. So what'd you think, Jason?
I think that we're off to a great start for the season. It was, you know, a lot to get in there, a lot to catch up. First episodes are always kind of rough, like you had a lot to get through there. But you know, you've got to catch up, you've got to reset the stage, you've got to move a lot of furniture around to kind of get it, anybody who may have just wandered into this crazy sci-fi show, at least somewhat able to watch it. And in this case, you know, we only get a little bit of the crew back together and we gain some new faces. So that always makes for a different crew dynamic, right? Because we only get a partial bit of the crew and only, even then, only for part of the episode. So what about you?
Yeah. And also, despite all these new things, they do a good job of recapping everything because, you know, back in the day, it was like, what, months between seasons? Unlike in this case, it was like a couple weeks for us. So always good to get a recap. But yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a good, solid conclusion to the cliffhanger ending. Although it's still a cliffhanger of where's Moya and Rigel, Dargo and Aaron. But still, you know, we have a little resolution to the cliffhanger. You know, John's hanging around, doing his thing, gets interrupted. You know, we get a brand new cast member who's got all kinds of cool things. So it's kind of neat. It was a nice action-packed start to the season. So it's always good to start on a adrenaline rush, high note kind of thing. So. And as this is the last season, which we know that, but they didn't at the time. It's nice that it starts off on a good note and hopefully continues that way throughout the end of the season. But yeah, overall, loved it. Thought it was great. And we'll see how we do here.
So. Yeah, which actually leads to a side question that you may not know answer the two yet, so maybe we'll have to wait and see. But how long was the hiatus between the end of this season and Peacekeeper Wars?
It was almost like 2 years, like a year, at least a year and a half.
Okay. So the longest hiatus is still yet to come. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, as they didn't know it was the end of the season, they left on a cliffhanger at the end of the series. So yeah, you're like, oh, you're killing me. You can't do this. So, I remember being really, really mad.
I'm sure we'll get there, but yeah, I can't imagine. Okay. I just wanted to compare how long this, if this was our longest hiatus or not longest, but you know, versus the end, how quickly we got that. So.
Yeah, so think of the size of the beer that November.
Yeah, right. Methuselah over there.
So like we said, we were introduced to lots of things this episode. First off is our temporary Leviathan, Elec, and a female pilot, who's just named Pilot. I guess no originality there, but yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so when pilots get together, how do they tell each other apart?
Yeah, is it like sub-vocal? Like, you know, the pilot, you know, it means things we can't hear? I don't know. You know, we're just like, hey, pilot. Everybody turns around, looks at you like... And then, you know, Crichton's trying to finish his wormhole equations, although I guess he's out of body parts, and now he's writing basically over everything he gets his hands on. Walls, crates, the floor, whatever. They mentioned that they can't help him with fuel, so he's kind of stuck there until they die. And it's just him, Pilot, and his little DRD buddy that he's nicknamed 1812, and for some reason, I guess because it's cool and it's a great piece of music, has taught it to play the 1812 Overture all the time, which is pretty funny.
That would definitely drive me insane if that was what I had to listen to all the time, though. As much as I like it, I think I need a different radio station.
Yeah, or at least maybe give him a couple show tunes, you know, yeah, something. I don't know. So, and, you know, John's little moment of zen here, of course, as always, goes completely sideways as the ship suddenly crashes into the bay where, of course, he's working and, of course, smashes a bunch of the crates his equations are on. But we get our newest crew member, Sokozu, out of it. So I guess, you know, take the good with the bad there.
What was her name again?
Yeah, I'm just going to go with Sokozu. I'm not going to attempt to say her like Jewel. I'm not going to say Jewel's full name. It's just Jewel. That's it. That's all I got. Oh, I guess it's cool because the writers kind of made her really interesting right off the bat. I mean, you know, you get to learn all kinds of stuff about her this episode. You know, the first and foremost being that she says she can't use translator microbes, so she has to learn languages the hard way, or in her case, the really easy way. So she must have some ability of language learning, but. So, you know, get that little cool, fun scene with her asking John, like, what's this? What's that? You know, make sentences, nouns, verbs, recite your alphabet. And of course, here in America, when he recites the alphabet, he does it by singing, like we all learned in school or on Schoolhouse Rock or wherever we learned it from. And by the way, I kind of still sing it that way anytime I have to do the alphabet. If I want to figure out how far a letter is from any other letter, I kind of sing through the letters and count. So it's kind of funny. So
yeah, especially if you need to figure out, like, what number a letter is within the alphabet. For some reason, that's something that we get asked, so I have to do, you know, count my fingers or whatever and do the same song. I guess I will say that that's my one nitpick with this episode was she can't use translator microbes, but she could also talk to him right off and ask him to talk. So how did she tell him she can't use translator micro? Anyway, don't think about it, but that's my nitpick. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it too hard, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's a fun character thing, but yeah, and we'll see if it goes throughout the rest of the season when she encounters some new race. Does she be like, what are they saying, huh, what? Or she knows everything because she's been through this part of the galaxy and John's just the new guy, and she doesn't, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm going to have to headcanon, because we already saw that she didn't have any trouble with Chiana and Pilot. I mean, Rigel. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're assuming that they're speaking their native languages, right? So she's obviously met the Baris and Hynerians before, and Pilots before, apparently. So.
I don't know if she's met a pilot, though, because she's never been on a ship. Anyway, we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, she speaks pilot, he said, because she understands what he said. She said, so.
Mm.
But interesting, yeah. So we'll see how this goes.
Again, not to nitpick, but there's my nitpick.
Yep. And of course, she didn't just crash because she just felt like it. She's being hunted by these Grudek people. Either that's their gang or organization, or their probably not their race. I think it's probably like their organization they work for. And they're looking for tuberary tissue, which apparently is some kind of delicacy for other cultures. So kind of similar to, or it's the equivalent of like rhino horns or other earth animals people used to or still hunt for their supposed curative properties or health properties or whatever. She manages to have found this Leviathan sticker burial space, since she'd rather harvest old dying Leviathans, since they're better than young ones. And, you know, we learned that these Grudek aren't exactly honorable kind of folk, and they go back on their promise to her and try to kill her, so she can't tell anybody else about this wonderful sacred burial space. So she had no reason to stay, so she left.
Yeah. On that one, I did get a pretty good laugh at the Klingon thing, because as soon as I saw the Grudek, the first thing I thought was, oh man, they just like totally ripped off some Klingons. And he immediately threw out some speaking Klingon to them. So I laughed because I was on the same wavelength.
Yeah, it was funny. Because when he starts throwing out Klingon, like I knew, oh my, oh wow, he's throwing Klingon at them. That's great. I love it. Way to cross your sci-fi streams there. Good job. And, you know, John decides that, you know, nah, why don't you guys leave instead? I'm not going anywhere. And that doesn't work out so well. So, of course, you know, after a little gun battle, they run away. But, of course, they've got a little ace up their sleeve, so to speak. They release this multi-legged hound thing, Bryn's Hound. And during the course of that, we learn that Sokozu can run up the walls by shifting her gravity center, as she keeps saying. So that was pretty cool, a little Matrix throwback, which I guess this has only been like still like maybe 2-3 years after the Matrix movie and before the next Matrix movie. So everybody's still Matrix crazy.
Mm.
Trying to capitalize on that movie somehow. And I guess she tries to encourage John to do the same thing. I'm like, uh-huh, sure. Not possible for little poor humans. We can't do that.
No, we have established our vessels are too big. So.
Yeah, that's right. We've got too many vessels in our legs. Can't too big. Gets bitten on the leg badly as he tries to get away. So, you know, if only he had smaller veins, right?
Yeah. My only comment there is that for somebody who's so smart, or at least book smart, she seems to lack concepts such as how other species have limitations and work. So I just kind of chalk that up to just like she'd never actually been on a Leviathan. Maybe she hasn't encountered all the stuff that she's read about, right?
Yeah, or because she doesn't know his language, she figures maybe he's able to do things she can do. So, hey, do this like I'm doing, see? It's easy. No.
Yeah.
And then we kind of start getting the band back together, so to speak. Well, because while Sokozu's fixing up John and complaining about his large veins, he gets a call from Chiana and Rigel. They somehow managed to come back to the area and just kind of, I guess, figured, hey, here's Leviathan, must be on here.
Well, so, and I guess that means that Pilot dozed off again, because this time she didn't alert him to a ship. So
yeah, maybe she's still being affected from the Grudek there. So they go down to get them, but of course run into the Grudek and the Hound. And this time the Hound manages to bite off Sokosu's hand, which apparently she can just reattach and it'll start regenerating or merge back and become useful again. So that's really cool. So they've kind of gone out of their way to make a really interesting character with Sokozu.
Yeah, which I guess since she's sticking around, we'll find out even more about her. What I was trying to figure out is she going to be a replacement for Jewel, or do we end up with both? Or
no, but they both stay through. And as we learned last time, you know, the crazy woman that nobody knows where Grandma came from, you know, she hangs around.
That's a lot of crew members to get in trade for Krace. So, good trade.
And we lost Stark too. So, you know, unless he comes back as a guest star later, but yeah. So we kind of lost two and gained two, I guess. So yeah, I guess it kind of evens out.
Yeah, I guess Stark's been gone so long now.
forgot all about.
Yeah, it's kind of like you know, I don't know, sand. You know, it's just you kind of roll with it. So.
Actually, we gained one because we got the woman. So, yeah, we're getting bigger and bigger. We got more cast members to deal with. So,
I guess the Leviathan will grow to accommodate the crew.
Yeah. But we do learn that Chiana and Rigel had to come back here because everywhere they go, and literally she means everywhere, Commandant Graza has put out the wanted dead or alive beacons. that we saw way back in, what, season one, maybe? Yeah, season one, right, when they met on the planet with, what's her name? The woman that stole the wormhole technology.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was season one.
I can't remember her name. Start with an F, maybe? Anyway, whatever, her. As soon as we log off for the night here, I'll remember what it was, but that's... But yeah, so
I barely remember your name, so I'm doing good over here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you are, who are you? Yeah, so, you know, Chiana says she's got the 5 million bounty on her head. Rigel, however, says, haha, mine's 7.
Which, so, that was very Rigel, so yes.
Of course, you know, I'm worth more. And all because John pissed off Graza last season, which, yeah, we knew that was coming. So, you know, John's mouth always gets him into trouble. And unfortunately, he's taking his friends down with him this time. And we get to learn that Chiana's premonition abilities evolved, either normally or after she's being tortured by winning too much at that cheap-proof casino. So much for that. So now it slows down time instead, but she gets really bad headaches and temporary blindness, which gets longer and longer, or maybe eventually permanent? Who knows? We'll find out.
That's a problem.
Yeah, so it'd be fun to see how that works this season. Because I'm sure they'll keep using it, because why mention it if they weren't going to use it again?
So. Right. So, and it's progressively make her bounce longer and longer, because they keep needing her to do it. So.
Yep, okay. Take one for the team, yeah. And we got kind of a little funny scene where they get the hound to jump through the hole in Elac that was covered up by that membrane using Rigel as bait, which is kind of funny when, you know, John's talking to somebody, you see Rigel like floating in, back in the background across the screen, and the hound runs after him.
Yeah, and the sheep noises, I was enjoying that.
Yeah. And then, you know, John shaking his butt like, come get this, hey, you know, whatever. So, yeah. That's Farscape. Got your crazy humor with the serious stuff.
Oh, he definitely gave it to you in this episode. It was all over the place.
Yeah, and plus he's gone stir crazy after months of being by himself and having a DRD nonstop singing the 1812 Overture at him. Yeah. So. And then after that's taken care of, they come up with their plan, which is a good plan, actually, to kill the Grudex without harming Elac too much, since they don't have anywhere else to go and they kind of need Elac. So, you know, they got to shoot those three hoses in a certain sequence to only kill the Grudex section there and not blow up the entire ship, which, you know, always a plus. So, you know, we get to see Chiana's new thing in action, new ability, which is kind of neat, as she's, you know, kind of Matrix-y dodging pulse pistol blasts in the air, which, okay, cool. Again, love the Matrix themes, apparently.
Like you said, you got to capitalize on that, you know, craze, so.
Yep. You know, we get the funny bit with her reaching out to Sokozu to help pull her up, and I guess her hand's not quite merged back on yet and rips it off.
Yeah, you gotta let that stuff set for 24 hours, you know?
You know, it's like super clear. You gotta let it sit for, like, you know, you gotta put like for like a clamps on it. You know, you gotta make sure it doesn't move. You know, you gotta let all that stuff. John manages to do everything in the proper order, but the little counterweight system doesn't work, and he starts to fall. Rigel just kind of like, yeah, no.
I'll get you. Oh.
Yeah. Hey, no, not really. Not happening. And he plummets into that nice, icky, bluish-black pool of bat droppings that all Leviathans have at the bottom. Oops, icky.
I totally forgot that it was actually bat droppings until you hit the recap. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what that was. I just thought it was glowing sludge there for a minute. I forgot why it was there.
Yeah. Jewel was not having it when she was there. And, yep, I can imagine. I'm assuming it smells. They didn't really say that. But
and he
you would think. I don't know.
He went full, like, you know, platoon or whatever, like going through the muck with just his eyes, like that's commitment right there.
Yep, he went for it. So props to Ben there for going taking one for the team there, right in there. And then at the end, we kind of get Sokozu is going to hang around to get her life back, because, you know, where else is she going to go? I guess in this area, I guess the Grudex are around there, so they probably get word out that hey, there she is. And Elac and her pilot have agreed to leave the Sacred Burial Space, even though they came here to die, because they want to repay their debt to John and them for saving them a little while longer, I guess, and take them to some planet where John thinks the others of Moira's crew might be. Not really sure how he might know that, but yeah. I guess whatever. Anyway, we'll just hand wave that away there. And we cut to John at 1812, working on wormhole equations again, picking up where he left off, maybe, if he can figure out what was destroyed, what wasn't, I guess, but there you go.
Which gives us great bookends to the episode, right? Because he starts out with the 1812 working on equations, and he ends the episode with 1812 working on equations.
Yeah, and then we cut to our ending credits with the overture playing, which is kind of funny. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Because usually I skip the credits, but I'm like, wait a minute. All right, and then I guess we only have like a little B plot, I guess you could call it. in John's head, where we first cut to him on a beach with Harvey running through the sand and surf. And, you know, Harvey rocking the wide-brimmed hat and a wild t-shirt. So, nice job. Welcome back, Harvey. And he kind of tells him, you know, stay focused on wormholes, forget all the other stuff. You know, you've got destiny, a skill, you know, a drive. They get interrupted by Aaron nearby, who's really pregnant. And then kind of other scenes later, they kind of argue about whether it's a boy or a girl, who the father is, feel a baby kick. So all the things that you'd expect. And I guess kind of we could kind of therefore get our title, so to speak, kind of Crichton, i.e. the baby kicks.
Yeah. So I guess you could argue on which Crichton it is, but it's still Crichton, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, again, as we even the crew argued with back when the twinning thing happened, that it's basically the exact same person. You know, all the tests prove that they're basically the exact same people, same person that just got divided effectively. So, yeah, I mean, it's got to be the other Crichton's baby, because this Crichton and Aaron haven't done anything, because she wasn't up for, you know, wasn't in that mindset, you know, even though he probably would have been, but she definitely wasn't. So,
yeah,
it's got to be the Black John, Green John, whatever. Anyway, I can't remember. The other John.
Yeah, the other one. And then, you know, while it's a cool little title drop in the B plot, I'll have to say, I wish we'd had some more Harvey, especially this like beach frantic Harvey, because he had a very Doc Brown from Back to the Future vibe going on. I was kind of waiting for him to be like, "Great Scott," or something, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, and there's a good job by the extras in the background, or I guess they tried not to cut to like non-actors there, because no one bats an eye that there's some guy in a like black leather dominatrix looking outfit thing with a hat on and a wild t-shirt. So, yeah. Just like, nothing to see here. Happens all the time. You know, nothing to worry about.
Oh, maybe it does over there. You don't know. Don't judge.
I don't know. I had never been to Australia. I don't know how these things work.
It was the 2000s, man.
Yeah, you know, anything went back then, you know. And then in the final beach scene in John's head there, Aaron's not pregnant anymore. And John basically says, "I'm done with this. I'm not coming back because it won't change anything." And just makes him all sad. You know, he's got to focus on his wormhole equations. Guessing first to find out where Moya went, because that's important, because, you know, he feels probably responsible for that. And then after that, I don't know. Is he going to try to find Aaron? Is he going to go home in his head? That's probably what he's thinking. But his only options are.
Yeah, so I guess we'll kind of wrap it up and see where he thinks he's going now that he's had time to think.
Yeah, because that's the whole point of last episode, is he can't have it both. He can't take Aaron to Earth, because then Scorpius will follow, or Peacekeepers will follow, or Scarians will follow and do nasty things to Earth. So he's going to, if he solves the equations, he's still going to stay around on Moya with Aaron. Now Aaron's left, you know, Moya's disappeared. So it's kind of like, now what do you do? So
yeah,
probably, I guess if he can't find Aaron, then he's going to go home. I would, you know, in his head, I'm thinking that's what he thinks is the options.
Guess we'll find out.
Yep, we got 21 more episodes to go, so we'll see what happens. Plus a two-part miniseries, so, you know, he's got plenty of time to think through his options there. All right, anything else to talk about that we didn't talk about already?
No, I think, like we kind of said at the opening, this was a good kickoff to the next season, and, you know, we know that it's going to be the last, but either way, you know, they did a good job of getting all the pieces back, and, you know, we've got our crew to reassemble, but new faces, new stories. Yeah, we're back.
Yep, same bickering. So, yeah, just new people, same, different bickering, same bickering.
Yeah, now Chiana has somebody else to yell at. So, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, so now we got Chiana, the Chiana, Jewel, and Sokozu hate triangle there or whatever.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes. Yeah. All right, so next time on the Farscape portion of the podcast, we will do, of course, Season 4, Episode 2, What Was Lost, Part 1, Sacrifice. So, hey, already got the first multi-part of the season. So, doing our usual guessing game of what does that title mean? Yeah, so at least the first two-parter officially named of the season, if you don't count the end of Season 3 and this episode of Season 4 being kind of a bookends to one another, which I think that's the quickest they've done, jumped into a multi-parter. Because Season 3, their first two-parter was when Zan died, and that was like, what, episodes 4 and 5 or something like that?
Sounds
or
right.
Even 3 and 4. So, yeah, they got even quicker on this one. I guess they've learned that two-parters or multi-parters do well. So let's jump into that real quick.
Yeah, keep using them.
Yeah, it works. As we said, multi-parters are always wonderful and fantastic. So as for what the title means, well, they lost Moya. Dargo and Eren think they're free after last season, but now they're not, thanks to Graeza, so they've lost their freedom. Elak and Pilot have lost their goal of dying in the sacred Leviathan burial space, so that might be the lost part. As for what the sacrifice part could be, I don't know. Do we lose Elak and Pilot, new Pilot, so soon? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I'm pretty sure all the characters we met before in this season, so they're not going to sacrifice somebody else. So I don't know. That's about all I got.
Yeah, I'm going to go with, I don't know, maybe John moving past Eren for a little bit, which you know won't last, but you know that's been our major loss, right? Or maybe the crew being lost amongst themselves. I'm focusing more on the lost part, not the sacrifice part. Yeah, now that you've said it, I kind of think the sacrifice part might be Alec and Pilot, but I kind of hate that. I've enjoyed having a different Leviathan to see kind of kick around, so I'd like to see him at least make it. Well, I sort of say a couple episodes, but we know four is promises, right? That was kind of in the trivia, so. Yeah, you're probably right. One other bit of things I wanted to touch on. We found out at least a possible age for a Leviathan dying, passing from old age, right? Because we find the age of Elek. So
yeah, 350 cycles. That's a good run there.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I guess we'll find out next time.
Yeah, although it could be like sacrifice. I'm thinking like if they do find Dargo, then he might have to sacrifice his plans of getting his revenge on the guy that killed his wife, so because you know you have to join back up with the band here, right? So.
Yeah, or maybe it's all done and they have to get him out of jail or something because he's already gone and got himself caught. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm guessing they're going to find Eren and Dargo first to string along the "Where's Moya" thing to make that kind of like a you know, ooh, what's going on, you know? But I don't know. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, my guess is Dargo first and then Eren, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Because if Jewel got off the ship somehow, that's where Moya was. So then they would find Moya. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. All right. So that concludes the Farscape portion of the podcast. So after our stunningly short Bad Batch theme music, all of like 5 seconds of it, we will discuss the middle third of the Bad Batch.
Yeah. So if you're coming back for Farscape and don't want to hang out, we'll see you next week or next episode. But otherwise, Bad Batch.
All right, so we got 6 episodes to go through here, so we'll just do the usual quick recaps, since we're not going to go into the extreme recap, because we'd be here forever, especially with a third of a season to cover. So you want to do the first one, and since I did the big one, then we'll just kind of alternate that.
Yep.
Back and forth. All right.
All right, so I'll go ahead and jump into the first one with Season 3, Episode 6, Infiltration. Guarded by Rex and his fellow rogue clones, Avik Singh, the former senator of Raxus, secretly meets with Rio Chuchi, I'm going to slaughter the name, sorry, to discuss the formation of a rebel movement against the Emperor. Until, that is, a clone assassin strikes.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, dun, dun. The attack fails, and the assassin is captured and pressed for information about Tantus, but another assassin is sent out to kill him before he can talk. Among his equipment, Rex's men find a register listing Omega as one of his assigned targets, prompting Rex to summon the Batch to his base on Teth. Omega and Crosshair relate what little they know about the Imperial movements and the clone assassin division formed by Hemlock. Upon hearing that they have captured one, Crosshair warns them that a secret tracking implant inside the operative, but then the second assassin strikes, killing the captive. The base is accidentally blown up, and an Imperial retrieval team, led by Commander Wolf, arrives to recapture Omega.
And then we jump right into it, literally, because they dropped it at the same time, Episode 7, Extraction. So we jump in right where that left off, with the Bad Batch, Rex, and his few remaining surviving troopers making their way through the ruined base, pursued by Wolf's men and the clone assassin, the latter in defiance of Wolf's orders to stay there and don't get involved. The fugitives launch a shuttle, but the assassin shoots it down, forcing a crash landing and a rough trek to an extraction by Echo. The assassin pursues them on his own until he goes over a waterfall after facing Crosshair in a duel. And at the extraction point, Wolf catches up to them, but after being confronted by his old friend Rex and the truth behind the Empire's treatment of clones, he lets the survivors escape. As they depart, Rex advises Hunter that in order to keep Omega safe, they have to find out why she is so important to the Empire.
which leads us into episode 8, Bad Territory. Fee, who's been asked by the Batch to make inquiries about the Empire's M-Count project, reports that bounty hunters have been hired to search for subjects with that special trait. Believing that Fennec Shand may know the answer, Hunter and Wrecker decide to seek her out, leaving Omega and Crosshair on Pabu. While Shand knows nothing herself, she refers them to another bounty hunter who might, in exchange for them helping her capture her current target, Salar Saris. After a difficult hunt, they bring Saris down, but Shand secretly informs another party about the Batch. On Pabu, Crosshair refuses to talk about the trauma he's endured on Tantus, which impairs his sniping skills. Omega helps him overcome this handicap by teaching him meditative techniques.
And then we got episode 9, The Harbinger, or Harbinger, Harbinger. While waiting on Pabu, the Batch encounters Shan's contact, who turns out later to be Asajj Ventress, who informs him that the M-Count signifies a person's innate connection to the Force. Which, you know, we all knew that, but whatever, anyway.
Oh, that's what that was.
Yeah. Yeah. What? No. Yeah, I won't go on about episode. Anyway. Ventress tests Omega's ability using Jedi techniques, but once the Batch discovers her Ventress's identity, their distrust of her turns into outright hostility. Omega is convinced that Ventress is sincere and continues the tests, but during her final trial at sea, Omega inadvertently summons a large sea monster, of course, which attacks them. Ventress rescues Omega and pacifies the creature, gaining trust with the rest of the Batch. Ventress claims that Omega's M-count is low, but then, after she's gone, indirectly admits to the adult clones that she was lying. Before leaving, she warns them that they will not be safe on Pabu while the Empire continues hunting Omega.
In episode 10, Identity Crisis, all over the Empire, children revealing Force sensitivity are snatched up and delivered to Tantus. With Nala Se's imprisonment, Hemlock reluctantly promotes Emery Carr to her vacant position and familiarizes her with Project Necromancer. Once witnessing the callous brutality with which the children used as specimens were treated, Carr slowly becomes disillusioned with the Empire and the righteousness of her work. Facing the cancellation of his project's funding, Hemlock learns that his clone assassin from Teth has tracked down Fi as one of Omega's contacts and sends him after her.
And then we got our final episode of our little podcast recap this time, episode 11, Point of No Return. The clone assassin infiltrates Fi's ship during a refueling stop and hacks her navigation computer, learning about Omega's whereabouts on Pabu. Just as the Bad Batch prepare to leave the planet, the assassin arrives and confirms their presence, destroys the Marauder, and calls in the Imperial Strike Team. With their means of escape cut off, the rest of the Batch tries to evade the pursuers while Hunter leaves to steal a gunship. Unfortunately, Hunter fails, and after that, Omega decides that the only option is to surrender herself, both to spare the people of Pabu and to enable the Batch to trace her back to Tantus. Crosshair attempts to plant a tracker on the ship that's leaving and fails, and the assassin leaves with Omega. All right, so that's a quick recap of a third of the season down, one third to go. So kind of overall, high level, what do you think there of these six episodes?
So I guess I'll start off with, does it really have to end?
I know. I love that. This has been such a great run.
Yeah, I'm just going to miss this show. I mean, it's good stories. At this point, we're getting, and I realize we're winding down, right? We're in the blast stretch at this point. So there's almost no filler. Just every episode, you know, even the ones that are, and I'm sure we'll get there as we kind of talk a little bit more about the characters, but, you know, the episodes that don't even have the Batch in them are major story moves, right? I mean, the plot just keeps moving. So, yeah, I'm going to miss it. It's been a great show.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it here in a bit, but yeah, I love when they do, yeah, like episodes not about the Batch, where it's just more about either what's going on somewhere else or just what's happening in general in this universe, or like with regular people doing regular jobs, so to speak, like the one Coruscant episode last season and that kind of stuff. It's just fascinating that they're weaving all this stuff together and, you know, showing you like the whole, you know, world of Star Wars that, you know, you wouldn't have normally gotten on a movie because they don't have time to spend on that kind of stuff in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of time in here, so.
Yeah, so I guess kind of go back a little bit to the beginning of, well, this episode 6 here. So we kind of get the beginnings of the slightest glimpse of what the rebellion will be about, you know, informing with Senator Chuchi and Avi Singh. So, you know, not a lot, you know, which is fine. You know, that's kind of what Andor is for, not really Bad Batch. But I'm kind of glad that they did talk about it because it's nice to see, like I said before, Filoni kind of weaving in everything together into this whole tapestry of Star Wars, so to speak. You know, if you want to make a grandiose kind of poetic gesture here.
Yeah, and to keep on my theme of time, right? I mean, it'd be kind of interesting. I'm wondering with Chuchi and Singh, you know, are we going to see some failed rebellion attempts before the successful ones kick off? I mean, are they the ones that maybe started, or do they fail? Because I don't remember us hearing them about them in the future, right? You know, this the media we have. So do they fail, and then it's not till later that we get, you know, Mon Mothma and some of the stuff from Andor kicking in. I mean, we've got so much room to play out here. So
yeah, I mean, if I wanted to, which I haven't, well, though now I might want to, is yeah, trying to get like the timeline, like when's the Bad Batch happen, when's Andor happen, you know, when's Rebels, you know, just kind of see like what's the gap between these kind of things, like yeah, how close are we to the rebellion kicking off into full swing, which is, you know, which has to be like small pieces at a time. It can't be like this giant rebellion, so it's got to, you know, start one step at a time, and we're kind of seeing that throughout these various animated live action shows. It's kind of, I love it. I love world building, as I'm sure I've said lots of times before. So it's kind of great to see like just kind of them plugging in the little gaps between all the episodes and series.
Yeah, I don't think we have, and I'm sure somebody's done the math, right? Not my strong suit. You know, we do know that we started with Order 66, right? So basically, right at the end of Revenge of the Sith, or kind of in the middle of Revenge of the Sith there. So that's kind of the starting point, at least for the Bad Batch storyline. We had missions with the Bad Batch before, but when the series kicked off, it was straight up Order 66. But I don't know how far we are past that at this point. You know, what were there any time jumps? Were there any, I mean, Omega's definitely aged as we've gone. So there's some time passage. I just don't know how far and how close it puts us to Rebels at this point.
Yeah, and even Andor, like if that's, how close is Andor to Rogue One, right? Like, and then obviously Rogue One feeds right into New Hope or / Star Wars.
Yeah, that's the only one I'm comfortable telling you when it is, because
yeah, exactly. Other than that, I got no idea. Yeah. And yeah, kind of going through most of these episodes is our new friend, the Clone Assassin. So it's kind of cool. You know, he's got this cool little assassin armor.
With the awesome shoulder buttons.
He does seem a match for most of the badges put together, at least from a distance. Once you get him up close, not so much. But, you know, that's how assassins work. They're usually good up front into hand-to-hand combat. They're good at, you know, sniping away from the distance. And, yeah, we learned that he's not exactly good at following orders to the letter. Kind of gets on Hemlock's bad side by not standing down, not kind of listening. Although Hemlock kind of comes around and he comes through and says, oh, here's where they are. So I guess, you know, hey, sometimes you have to bend the rules a bit there too. As long as it works, then your boss is happy. If it doesn't work,
yeah,
your boss not so happy.
You can push it if you win, right? So
right, yeah. So we'll see if that goes during the last half of the or third of the season here. I'm sure he's just really driven to complete this mission, you know, capture and deliver Omega. And now he has. Now what? Will they wind up betraying Hemlock or not? I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Definitely.
He's still a clone. And if he's got that same implant kind of thing, they hell had to obey orders and stuff.
Well, and we haven't seen much of him. Like, I don't think we've seen him out of the armor or anything like that yet. So there's still some fun stuff there. Part of me wants to be like, you know, if he's not a standard clone, which he doesn't seem to be, does that make him an honorary Bad Batcher? I mean, you know, maybe we end up with this guy joining the batch because, you know, got some kind of deviation himself, or kind of like Echo, maybe he's modified.
Yeah, and again, you know, we have all these clones floating around that aren't in, or at least aren't past, like, well, so far Andor and further than that. So at some point, they kind of drop off the radar here. So who knows, you know?
Yeah, we only know where three of them end up, so.
Mm-hmm. And kind of like we figured from earlier seasons, Omega's special. We knew that. Yeah, she's a clone, but not like the others. You know, she has some degree of midichlorians in her blood.
What's midichlorians?
Yeah. That's something I heard about kind of vaguely. I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of like there's only been three movies of Star Wars. I don't understand where this stuff's come from, but you know, whatever. It's fine. So these midichlorians are crucial to Hemlock's little Project Necromancer, which we talked all about last time, and how it's kind of seems to be the floating through the movies and TV shows here. Now, how much of it does she have? They aren't saying. You know, how it ranks with other Jedi's levels of midichlorians, again, they're not saying, which is fine. Don't need to know that. But, you know, Asajj kind of indirectly says it's, well, it's not low, so could be high, could just be more so than you would think from a regular person, because, you know, she got that huge creature summoned on Pabu, so it's interesting.
Yeah, which I guess I missed. I thought that came up because Asajj was summoning the stuff it fed on. I didn't realize that that was actually a summoned creature, but.
Yeah, 'cause she started, you know, closing her eyes and focusing, and then the big boy showed up there, so.
I have to go back and rewatch that. Because my thought on this was it'd be interesting to see if she's not actually force sensitive like at all, although they are putting a lot of time in her meditation. So,
Yeah,
but.
they're starting to push that to, like, you know, quasi Jedi, you know.
Yeah. But I think it'd be interesting if her blood, you know, isn't specifically the fact that she has an M count, but that they've found a way to use her to synthesize a binder so that you can take the M count from others and merge it into the clones, because clones can't seem to take a M count.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Yeah, like, where's it going? Because from that machine that we saw back in the first two episodes of the season, it's like, yeah, they're testing everybody's blood every day. So it's like, if they knew, well, of course, they didn't know she had the high M count or an M count, because they kept destroying, you know, not say kept destroying her blood, but they must not, know what they're doing exactly, because they keep, putting something else with it. So it's like, it's not, yeah, obviously it's like one part of the two parts they need to do with their big secret project here. So yeah, I'm kind of curious to see if they kind of expand on it here in the next episode or two here. I don't know. But for now, we don't need to know. Just know that, you know, they want Omega, she's got something they need. So there we go. That's all we need to know right now.
That's right.
Speaking of Asajj, we get to see her again, who's now kind of making up for her past wrongs, kind of. So
Yeah, with a new haircut.
yeah, new haircut, you know, new eye color, I think. I don't know, couldn't tell, but, you know, kind of lost that, like, evil Jedi look, you know, kind of, you know, it's a dead giveaway, you know.
Well,
Gotta...
and she switched lightsaber colors too, so.
Yeah, so that means she's good now, because it's not red,
Or
so,
she's
you know,
independent, right? And that
that's right.
yellow's been adopted as the I'm neutral or whatever.
Like third party
Yeah.
Jedi,
Not affiliated.
that's right, yeah. And it was kind of funny to see the Batch trying to take her on, because once they knew who she was, which, I mean, they fought along Jedi during the Clone Wars, so they probably knew they had no chance whatsoever, but they still did it because Omega's part of the crew and they gotta stand up for her. But yeah, she wiped the floor with them.
Yeah, as she should have. I mean, we saw her go toe to toe with some pretty powerful characters throughout the Clone Wars, so it would make sense for her, you know, struggle against them. I did enjoy seeing her. You know, it's always kind of cool that they bring in these characters that we, you know, what happened to so and so or where did so and so end up, right? So they're still out there. But I also appreciate that they didn't overuse her. You know, they didn't drag it. It wasn't like a multi episode. We didn't spend half a season on it. It's like, nope, get in, get what you need. We've got the appearance. We get some good scenes, and then she moves along.
Yeah, and that's probably the person that Fennec was calming at the end of her episode, you know, when they were, you know, she's probably telling Asajj where to go to find Omega.
Yeah.
She wasn't, you know, Fennec's not one to kind of be the, oh, I'll just kind of betray my bounty hunter code here and, you know, rat them out, and, you know, so nice to see things are, you know, consistent, you know, in the Star Wars universe there.
Yeah, I mean, when that originally aired, I saw some theorizing that it might have been Cad Bane, but I agree. I think it was definitely her that she was talking to, because as we see later, if it had been Cad Bane, it would have been he would Cad Bane would have no problem bringing in Omega. So,
Yeah, we'll talk about him in a second here.
yep.
I got some bones to pick with him later. But yeah, as we talk about, it's nice when they do, like, a episode that's major character free. And in this case, you know, the one with a Emery Carr and learning more what's going on at Mount Tantiss, I thought was a great episode. Which I guess we'll kind of maybe get into Mr. What's his face here. But so, you know, she's now the head researcher, because she kind of shoehorned her way in there, because, like, you know, hey, if not Nala Se, why not me, right? So okay, you know, he went for it. So okay, cool. You know,
Way to pitch yourself for promotion.
yeah, you know, you got to strike while the iron's
I don't know that I agree with her salary negotiation techniques, but you know.
yeah. Well, you know, so we get to learn all about Project Necromancer. Did not expect, I'll have to admit, a kind of a prison common area with force sensitive children in it. I did not have that on my bingo card. So, although, again, not really sure what else they're doing with them other than just taking their blood samples every day, and I guess like we said before, mixing it with the other thing that they have to have some reaction, whatever it is. Maybe, yeah, a stable midichlorian count. Maybe they're growing midichlorians. I have no idea what they're doing. So it's fun to speculate because, but you know, all we know is it's the end result is to have force sensitive clones. Therefore, what we saw again in Mandalorian, what we saw all tons of, literally tons, like I said before, in Rise of Skywalker. So we know the end result. So it's just a matter of how this fits into it, I guess. So we know Omega's got it in spades. That's what they're looking for. But I guess they keep doing experiments anyway, just in case they get lucky with what they have, I guess, if they can't get her.
So this is where my theory comes in of the binder, right? Because you've got, we know they've got two different sample pools. This is Jason's conspiracy corner here. You've got two different sample pools. You've got clones, and you've got force sensitive that they're kidnapping. So I don't think they're looking for changes in the force sensitives. They know they've got M counts, right? Once you've sampled a M count from one of these kids, they've got the M count. But they're taking those and trying to use them to mix with the blood they're drawing from the clones, because they're trying to figure out which clones may have had the capability to bind the midichlorians, the M count, into a clone. So it's the binder capability of a clone they're looking for, and the force sensitives are just there to give them M counts to work with. That's my conspiracy.
No, I guess it does kind of make sense, because if they're trying to clone non-force sensitive people and then give them force sensitivity, yeah, that would make sense. Yeah. Like you have to have a way to transfer the midichlorians to a non-force sensitive individual. So yeah, okay, I like it. It's a good theory. I like that.
It only breaks down on the fact that they keep capturing more kids, and you'd think that once you had a force sensitive M count to work with, you just keep getting blood from the same one. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's that too.
Again, and then, don't overthink it.
Yeah. And even going back to like the first season of Mandalorian, that's what they're looking for Grogu for, probably, to get his blood, you know, for the little experiments that Din shut down there. But, you know, it could be the same thing.
Right.
Just, you know, however many years later, they're trying again. So,
yeah, he was trying to do the same thing as the Emperor's clones were. I think each faction was trying to develop their own Force-sensitive clones.
So. Mm-hmm. Like their own little arms race kind of thing. Because, you know, that's what Jedi are good for, is just, you know, police work. Truck troops, yeah. So.
There's a dearth of law enforcement in the Empire.
But yeah, so it was cool to see like the whole kind of evolution of Emery, you know, dealing with the children there. You know, first she kind of starts talking to him, like, you know, no, don't talk to the experiments or specimens or whatever. And then she starts calling by their, you know, experiment name, you know, which is kind of funny. And yeah, as we see throughout the episode, yeah, that doesn't last too long, and you know, she gets all upset basically. And I mean, we'll see where it goes. I mean, see if she's like, we got four episodes to go. So does she sabotage the stuff at the end? You know, I don't know. I mean, assuming, I guess, from what we said before, Mandalorian and later Rise of Skywalker, it does take a while to perfect this, like, you know, decades. So maybe they don't wind up fully stopping Hemlock's research at the end, but set it back a long time. So
yeah, I mean, what, we're at least 30 years at this point, so.
Yeah, at least for to Rise of Skywalker, where they finally perfected. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, this episode, I'll have to say, yeah, the whole Cad Bane thing really made me upset, because you cruel, heartless bastard, how can you, you know, capture a toddler from his mom? I mean, that just made me really upset. So, you know, awesome job, writers. You got the anger in the right spot there, and it got us all, you know, ooh, Cad Bane's evil guy. Of course, his name's Cad Bane, so what do you expect? But
yeah, who believe it or not, it's actually one of my favorite animated characters, who is one of the reasons I have issues with Book of Boba Fett, but we'll bypass that for a little bit. Yeah, I think the episode accomplished what it was supposed to, right? My youngest actually mentioned while we were watching it that he didn't like that episode. He blamed it on the fact that there was no Bad Batch, but I think that, you know, it's tough to get through, because that was their goal, right? They want you to make you feel it. They want it to be unpleasant.
Yeah, because, you know, the Empire is not, you know, all kumbaya, touchy feely. I mean, that they're, you know, cruel, ruthless, totalitarian kind of people, and they hire people to help them that are like that. So yeah, I mean, it fits, and you know, I do like Cad Bane in general, just like, you know, the way he talks, like the kind of like the old Western gunslinger, and he looks like one, and it's a cool thing. I get it. And, he's just basically, the bad bounty hunter, as opposed to the neutral bounty hunters or the good bounty hunters, so I get it, good job. But yeah, they definitely knew how to push people's buttons, and they did for sure in this one.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
Yep. And then kind of as we go along, we kind of get our Empire Strikes Back moment here in the last episode that we've seen so far. The point of no return. Everything looks grim for our group. Hemlock's team finds Babu. They blow up the Marauder. So, Shades of Mandalorian, you've lost part of the crew, basically. You've lost their ship, which you've identified for the last three seasons with these guys. They kind of injure several of them, or at least Wrecker. They kind of took Hunter out of the whole thing, basically. He had to swim for miles back to shore or whatever. So he was basically done at that point. Yeah. He wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah, we don't know exhausted. We don't know his condition, but he's not. Yeah, he wasn't there for a lot of it.
Yeah, having to swim in armor for how far there. Yeah, he's out of it for a while. So, Omega does the brave and only thing she can probably do is just, offer to surrender if they'll leave Pabu unharmed, which is a risk because, the Empire doesn't have to keep promises to rebels. We've shown that, in lots of other seasons and other series before that, sure, wink, wink, we'll do it, yeah.
Well, so. And she really didn't get a promise, right? She just surrendered, so.
Yeah, I mean, if they said no, where's she going to go? She can't run away at this point because nope. She's surrounded, so, yeah. And, because at that point, they're also getting ready to torch the poor homeless villagers there. So, you had to do something, right? So that's the only logical thing to do. Hey, okay, I'm here, fine. Take me and leave everybody home. Leave everybody alone.
Yep.
And, of course, they have a cunning plan. Crosshair will hit the ship with a tracker and they'll track her back to Tantus. Unfortunately, his nerve or mental issues are still there and he really whiffs. I mean, it's not even close.
I don't think it was even that. I think it was more the timing of he ran into that last batch of troopers and couldn't get in position quick enough to have a...
Got delayed just enough where it was too far a shot.
Yeah, he couldn't get... He never actually made it to the top. I think he was aiming for the top of that rise and he had to take the shot from low. So...
Yeah, so now we'll have to figure out, is there like a backup plan somehow? Like, did she smuggle another device on her somewhere that they didn't see? Because she took her hat off at the end. So I was thinking, oh, maybe like there's a device hidden in her hat, maybe. Or since she started meditating or something, is there going to be some kind of, she only had four lessons with Asajj. Now she's like the Force Master and can like project her thoughts or something. Like, here's where I am. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. I think we'll have to have maybe Imri or something else be the catalyst there to get her out. I don't think they're gonna. I think we're funny enough. We've circled back to the beginning of the season, right? We're right back. Crosshair's out, but as far as Omega goes, she's right back at the same spot she was to start the season. I will echo what you said a minute ago, though. I hate when we keep losing good iconic ships, and the biggest heartbreaker in the Mandalorian for me was the destruction of the Razor Crest, and now we've lost the Marauder. So. Man, we just can't keep good ships.
Yeah, they hate these ships. Yeah.
Oh, gotta sell.
Although we have Echo, we're come pick him up, so he'll bring something. Yeah, well, maybe not another Marauder type ship, or maybe he will. I don't know. I don't know how prevalent they are around.
My theory is we've got to sell a new Lego set, so we need a different ship to sell a Lego set for.
Yeah, and call it the Marauder 2.
Well, just like what the Mandalorian upgraded to a Nubian fighter, so maybe we'll get I don't know, a freighter or something that looks like the Falcon.
Yeah. Is that really an upgrade though? I don't know.
No shower facilities, man. I don't understand this upgrade at all. But
yeah, and you've lost your little hold for your frozen carbonite people when you capture them, but that's not really his job anymore. So hey, whatever.
And the armory, you lost the entire armory.
Yeah, because. Although, I mean, at this point, because, they finally learned how to lock their ship here, and that gets blown up. So, I mean, you just can't win.
he did save the Gonk droid, though. That was important.
Yeah, we have a little buddy, because, you'll need power for whatever ship you get next, right? So, you need your little power droid.
Got to keep your battery charger.
I know we kind of blew through these, but, a lot of them are just kind of action pieces. You can't, talk too much about that kind of stuff. It was cool, but anything else, highlights we want to hit that we didn't talk about?
No, like I said, I really wish we were getting to season four, but we'll enjoy the last little bit.
Yeah, because we only got four left, so they really got to, if you want to have I guess all the cliffhanger tension's gone now. You have to wrap it up somehow, however it's going to wrap up. You got to get to Tantus, rescue Omega, I don't know. I'm thinking somehow sabotage a little bit the project, or get Hemlock to like lose his funding or something that they were threatening him to do before, or something to at least have some kind of small win or something. And then whatever they decide to do after that, like right off in the sunset, join up with Rex. Who knows? But then they got four to go to wrap all this up.
Yeah, I will say I'm as you point out, there's only four to go. I actually thought there was more, so now I'm sad there's only four. But I think I can't see how they can do that, right? There's just too much left between and that I keep mentioning the time, right? But there's so much time left and so much story left. I think we may be hitting the end of the Bad Batch, but I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get a our characters don't carry over to another series, right? We've got a lot of movement to do to get Rex, Wolf, and Gregor on that sand planet catching worms. So who knows what we've got in between in the next series, the next show, whatever medium they decide to use to tell this story. But I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get another animated feature in the Star Wars universe to keep going.
Probably, I would think so. And plus, we only have four episodes left to find tech, so I'm still holding out that he's still alive, even though that they put his goggles that are all cracked in the little museum on Pabu. But
Yeah,
okay.
I think you got your answer there when they put the goggles. That's exactly what I was going to say. Is these goggles were placed on the shelf,
No, it's still just goggles. You haven't seen a body. No body, no death. That's how it works in these shows. Yeah.
Slight tangent. Did you ever see the animated TMNT movie?
No.
There's a slight spoiler, but there's a scene there where they're putting their helmets on the trophy wall, because it takes place after they did the movies, and so they like the Shredder's helmet was on the wall, and they had a couple others, and there's a couple scenes where they add the helmet of the vict from the victory onto the wall as a trophy, and that's all I could picture when they were adding the goggles was, here's our wall of, whatever.
I can hold out hope till the end of this next four episodes here, and then, oh well, okay, I guess he's gone.
Maybe that's our next series. Maybe it's the tech show, and you find out what happened to tech in the new spin-off series.
He's working with Chu Chi and what's his name to form the rebellion. Yeah, that's
It'll
what
be Bad Batch Cyber, right? It'll have, him doing cyber things on the Empire. He'll become like a hacker against the Empire.
Yeah, there it could be a whole thing. It'd be like, Bad Batch Cyber, Bad Batch NCIS, bad.
I'm telling you, there's a whole law enforcement thing here they're not taking advantage of.
Mean, like, the A team, you do a whole spin-off.
Well,
Yeah.
basically, we've been watching the A-Team, so
True, yeah. So.
all Hunter's got to do is say he loves it when a plan comes together, and we're there. So,
Man, like, does Wrecker hate getting on planes? Or no, he doesn't really. No, he's like, he likes flying. He has
that's
the.
tough. Could you imagine if you had a character that couldn't stand to fly on the ships?
Yeah.
They got to drug you every time they change planets.
Yeah, I'm sure they got a guy that loves walking across, giant chasms on a small walkway because, that's all over the place,
No guardrails.
No. Not part of the architectural guild in the Empire. We don't believe in that sort of thing. All right. So next time we, in addition to our season four of Farscape, as we noted earlier, we'll discuss as much of the Bad Batch is out before next time, which not sure how I think they're only doing like one a week now, so maybe another month. I think they're done with the multi episode drops at the same time. So I've got four left, got about a month. So yeah, maybe we'll see how it goes, but with our schedules at work and stuff. But yeah, maybe all by next time, maybe half by next time. Who knows? We'll see.
We'll figure it out.
Yep. As always, watch the show notes and what we say we're doing, that's what we're doing.
You'll know when
What we're
we
saying,
know.
yeah. What we're saying here, yeah. That's how it works.
That's how it works.
All right, so that is your homework, haha, for next time. And we'll see you then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.